a board today, so I'm just pulling up the verse here, and before I start chanting them, then everybody can pull them up on their phones. Okay, here we go. Oh, thank you so much. Try. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kanja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Bhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Labha Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Bihari, Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Jaya Om Vishnupad Paramhamsa Prairaja Kacharya Shudra Sarshi Shimadis Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki. Jaya Om Vishnupad Paramhamsa Prairaja Kacharya Ashutra Sarshi Shimadis Divine Grace Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada Ki. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the lotus feet of Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Glories to Sri Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, having invited the Supreme Lord into this assembly by chanting auspicious invocations, we now recite the 10th canto, chapter 20, verses 32 to 35. What I'll do is, I'll chant 32 on my own, and 33 is the one that we'll chant together. 34 is the one we'll chant together. So, yeah, so 10th canto, chapter 20, verse 34. If you would like to pull it up, we can then, when we get there, we'll chant. So for now, I'll chant 32, 33 on my own. So I hope I have your full attention. Evam nivasatostasmin ramakeshavayor vraje sharat samabhavad vyabhras svachambhav aparushanila. Translation by the disciples of His Divine Grace, Ki Jai. While Lord Ram and Lord Keshava were thus dwelling in Vrindavan, the fall season arrived, when the sky is cloudless, the water clear, and the wind gentle. I think we can relate to this now because it's fall in Chicago, the fall season. We can see the sky is very clear, wind is quite nice. Yesterday we went out for book distribution, the weather was really nice. And the water, well, we don't see much clear bodies of water, but I suppose in the fall season, bodies of water are clear. It's 10th canto, chapter 20, verse 32, Prabhu. Next verse. Sharada nirajopatya nirani prakritim yayuhu bratsnanam ivachetamsi punaryoga nishevaya. Translation, the autumn season, which regenerated the lotus flowers, also restored the various bodies of water to their original purity. Just as the process of devotional service purifies the minds of the fallen yogis when they return to it. Right. So the analogy here is being made to lotus flowers, which act to remove contamination from the water, just like bhakti purifies the minds of those who fell away from the path but then returned. Okay, in today's verse, Vyomno Brabham Bhutam Bhuta Shabalyam Bhuva Pankam Apam Malam Sharajaharsha Raminam Krishna Bhakti Yatha Shubham Vyomno Bhibram Bhuta Shabalyam Bhuvaha Pankamapam Malam Sharajahara Shaminam Krishna Bhakti Yatha Shubham. Please chant. Vyamno Brahmbhuta Shabalyam Bhuvaha Pankamapam Malam Sharajahara Shaminam Krishna Bhakti Yatha Shubham. One more, Prabhu. Vyamno Brahmbhuta Shabalyam Bhuvaha Pankamapam Malam Sharajahara Shaminam Krishna Bhakti Yatha Shubham. Mataji? Vyomno Brahmbhuta Shabalyam Bhuvaha Pankamapam Malam Sharajahara Shaminam Krishna Bhakti Yatha Shubham Vyomnaha. In the sky, up Brahm, the clouds, Bhuta, of the animals, Shabalyam, the crowded conditions, Bhuvaha, of the earth, Pankam, the muddy covering, Apam, of the water, Malam, the contamination, Sharat, the autumn season, Jahara, removed, Ashraminam, of the four members, of the members, of the four different spiritual orders of human society, Krishna for Lord Krishna. Bhaktihi, devotional service. Yatha, just as. Ashubham, all inauspiciousness. Can you grab the mic, please? Translation and purport by the disciples of His Divine Grace, Kijai. Autumn cleared the sky of the clouds. Let the animals get out of their crowded living conditions, cleaned the earth of its covering of mud, and purified the water of contamination. In the same way that loving service rendered to Lord Krishna frees the members of the four spiritual orders from their respective troubles. So it's a long purport, and generally it's hard to hear something for so long. So I thought today, to enhance our ability to like hear the purport, we'll all take turns reading one of the paragraphs. So you can start and then pass it down to whoever volunteers. Just read the first paragraph.
Purport. Every human being must perform the prescribed duties corresponding to one of the four spiritual orders of life. These divisions are 1. Celibate student life, brahmacharya. 2. Married life, grihastha. 3. Retired life, vanaprast. And 4. Renounced life, sannyas. A brahmacharya must perform many menial duties during his student life. But as he becomes advanced in loving service to Krishna, his superiors recognize his spiritual status and elevate him to higher duties. The innumerable obligations performed on behalf of wife and children constantly harass a householder. But as he becomes advanced in loving service to Krishna, he is automatically elevated by the laws of nature to more enjoyable spiritual occupations, and he somehow minimizes material duties.
Mm. Who wants to read next? Jai Dushan Prabhu.
Those in the vanaprastha or retired order of life also perform many duties, and these can also be replaced by ecstatic loving service to Krishna. Similarly, renounced life has many natural difficulties, not the least of which is that sannyasis, or renounced men, are inclined to meditate on the impersonal aspect of the Absolute Truth, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita 12.5. Klesho dikataras tesham avyaktasakta chetasham. For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Lord, advancement is exceedingly painful. But as soon as a sannyasi takes to preaching the glories of Krishna in every town and village, his life becomes a blissful sequence of beautiful spiritual realizations.
Beautiful. One more, last paragraph.
In the autumn season, the sky returns to its natural blue color. The vanishing of the clouds is like the vanishing of troublesome duties in brahmachari life. Just after summer comes the rainy season, when the animals sometimes become disturbed by the torrential storms and thus huddle together. But the autumn season signals the time for the animals to go to their respective areas and live more peacefully. This represents householders becoming free from the harassment of family duties and being able to devote more of his time to spiritual responsibilities, which are the real goal of life both for himself and his family. The removal of the muddy layer on the earth is like the removal of the inconveniences of vanaprastha life, and the purification of the water is like the sanctification of sannyas life by one's preaching the glories of Krishna without sex desire.
Try. If you know the prayers, please join me. Om Agyanante Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvetam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Shri Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakanvitamscha. Hey Krishna, Karuna Sindhu, Dina Bandhu, Jagatpate, Gopesha, Gopika, Kanta, Radha Kanta, Namostute, Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi, Radhe Vrindavaneshwari, Vrishabhanu Sute Devi, Pranamami, Hari Priye, Namo Mahavadanyaya, Krishna Prema Pradayate, Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya, Namne Gaura Tvishe Namaha, Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadhara, Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Manchakalpaturubhyascha, Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha, Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Good morning, and before I begin, I would seek the blessings of and well wishes of all the assembled devotees. Please bless me that I can speak something purifying for myself, inspiring, and loyal to the Shastra. We don't want to speculate, right, Adam? That's right. Okay, so I'm very excited about today's class, not because I'm speaking, but because these are really, really nice verses. And there's two very important points in these verses we just read. Basically, there's two main points. In verse 33, it compares the appearance of lotus flowers in the waters of Vrindavan to the purification caused by bhakti in the minds of the unfinished yogi. So we hear in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna that those who don't finish their journey of spiritual realization, then they continue in their next life from where they left off. Right? We heard about this. The unfinished yogi resumes his journey in his next life. So what's happening is there was some contamination in his mind that he wasn't able to fully conquer by his bhakti sadhana. He wasn't crying enough for the Lord's mercy, because if you cry enough, Krishna will remove all contamination from the heart. So then he didn't cry enough, he didn't do enough bhakti sadhana, therefore there was some contamination left in his mind. So in his next life, he resumes where he left off from in his previous life. That's why you see some people, they come to Krishna consciousness, they just take to it really fast. Why? Because they're picking up from a previous life. Some people, it's a more gradual entry. So anyways, the lotus flowers, because of the process of growing in a pond, their roots absorb contamination from the waters. In the same way, the process of bhakti sadhana removes contamination from the mind of a yogi whose journey is not finished. So I'm going to speak about this point first, which is the purification caused by bhakti. And then the second verse discusses the idea of how there's ashrams in this material world. There's four ashrams, four social orders of life. And bhakti is that which, you could say, makes the suffering in each of these ashrams manageable. There is suffering in every ashram. Whether you are a single man as a brahmachari, there is suffering there. Whether you're a grihastha, there is suffering there. It's just to do any ashram properly, there is suffering. Right? Any brahmachari will tell you that. It's not easy being a good brahmachari. It's not easy being a good grihastha. It's not easy being a good vanaprasthi. And it's not easy being a good sannyasi. It's very difficult actually to live our ashram with integrity. So I'll speak about that then in the second half of the class, about what it means to have an ashram with integrity. And what is the suffering that comes with each ashram, and how does bhakti minimize that, and why is it important to go through the ashrams, right? It's like very important to go through the ashrams carefully. One cannot jump to a position that one has not earned yet. So let us first speak a little bit about the purification caused by bhakti. Now, if I were to ask you, for example, this temple room, right? This temple building, what is it that supports this building? What do you think supports this building? The foundation. It's an architectural device that supports large buildings, right? What is it that supports our material existence? What is the foundation of our material existence? Adam? No, Adam. Okay. Alex? Ahankar. False ego. Can you scratch a little bit more? That's good. That's actually, so our acharyas explain what is the foundation of material existence. That's actually just the layer above the foundational layer of material existence. Just beneath that, there's one more thing actually. Anybody wants to think maybe what it could be? No, karma is actually a byproduct of false ego. No, lust is also a byproduct of false ego. It comes after false ego, actually. Once one has developed a false ego, then one has lust for particular objects, right? So for example, when you're a man, if you're a heterosexual man, you have lust for heterosexual women. If you're a homosexual man, you have lust for homosexual men. Right, so but lust is based on identity. So when you have a certain identity, a certain ego, then you lust after certain objects, right? For example, if your identity is, I'm an athlete, then you lust after sports equipment, like that. So it's a byproduct of false ego, but it's not foundational. There's something below even false ego. That's right, ignorance. What is the Sanskrit word for ignorance, Prabhuji, you know? Avidya. Avidya. So the word vidya means knowledge, and in Sanskrit, when you put the word a before another word, it's the opposite. So vidya and avidya. Avidya is the opposite of vidya, knowledge. Now, it's interesting, avidya has two facets. Okay, avidya means to not know something. Just like, for instance, this is a pair of kartals. Okay, if you take this to a tribe in Africa, or somebody who's not a devotee, why a tribe in Africa? Let's just go outside and you show this to them. They don't know what it is, right? They don't know what it is. Correct? Yes? However, when they think it's something else from its original purpose, that is also avidya. So they don't know what it is and they think, maybe it's a piece of jewelry and I could take this cloth out and put some string and hang it around my neck. And it looks kind of cool actually. It looks like a pendant, right? That is also avidya. So acharyas explain that avidya has two facets. To not know something and to mistake it for what it isn't. So in the same way, we don't know that we're not our bodies. We don't know who we are. Then we make the assumption that we are this body. You follow? That's the two facets of avidya. And from that comes false ego. Okay, I am this. I am Colombian. I am a sports star. I'm a skateboarder. I'm an artist. I'm a musician. I'm an insecure person. I'm a secure person. I'm an intellectual. I'm a philosopher. You know, all these identities, they emanate from ignorance or avidya, a sense of false ego. Then when there's a false ego, one develops lust. The things I like according to my false ego, right? So for example, we don't eat fish food. Nobody here eats fish food, right? Anybody here eating fish food recently? Snacking on some little crusted earthworms? No? Last we checked, no? Well, that's a good point. I do like seaweed. Okay, you got me there. In general, we don't eat fish food. Okay, we don't eat the stuff that comes in a plastic jar that we feed fish. Because our ego doesn't identify as a fish. Our ego identifies as human beings. So we create lust for things that human beings like. And then we create dvesha. Things that human beings don't like, right? So for example, fish food. You serve me fish food, I don't like it, but a fish will love it, right? So it's again based on false ego, raga and dvesha, things we like, things we don't like. And the final, you could say, support for our material existence from the false ego and the raga and dvesha is something called asmita, which means complete absorption in material life. One who has no awareness of the soul is simply living in the world, thinking about the things he likes, or things she likes, and the things she doesn't like. So in a nutshell, the acharyas have explained what is the foundation for material existence. Make sense? Now from this come three things. Again, we're talking about purification here. What is it that bhakti purifies? Bhakti will purify all of these things actually, our false ego, our raga, dvesha, asmita. But there's three more things that come from this, and we'll expand on this a little bit. The first is anya bhilasha. Distraction caused by desires separate from the interest of the Lord. So as a result of our material existence, we develop anya bilasha. We have desires for things that have nothing to do with the interest of the Lord, usually sinful activities, right? So for example, one might desire to become very, very rich just to have a mansion with sports cars. This has nothing to do with the interest of the Lord, right? But it's a desire we have in the material world. So as a result of our material existence, we develop anya bilasha. We also develop phala bhoga. Enjoyment of the fruits of worldly activities. So one has the desire for certain things in this world, right? To be maybe a famous artist, or to, it could be something philanthropic. I want to build 100 orphanages. That's good. It's not bad actually. It's nice. But it's not done with conscious awareness of the Lord, right? So it's still something material. One might have a desire to be famous. One might have a desire to be very rich, powerful, strong. And then enjoy those results. Why? So I can enjoy. I can enjoy the fact that I have money. Like, you know, Alex, maybe before he came to Krishna consciousness, he wanted to be like a vegan guitar playing guru, you know, biking around the country and singing songs and being like a vegan acharya, maybe, who knows, and you want to enjoy that, then there's a resulting enjoyment that comes from our material accomplishments. This is called phala bhoga. And the last thing that comes from our material existence is phala tyaga, when we renounce things that have nothing to do with the Lord. Sometimes I meet people when we're out doing book distribution or just at programs, and they find out we're spiritual, and they come up to me afterwards, like, you know, I'm living out of a suitcase, just two t-shirts and a pair of pants. That's nice, but that renunciation is not based on anything spiritual. It's just like, I want to live simply. That's the ultimate reason why they're doing it. I just want to live simply. So phala tyaga means when we engage in renunciation that doesn't have anything to do with spiritual advancement. It's just based on, I just want to live simply. Or dieting. Dieting is phala tyaga. You know, when people give up eating like delicious foods or rich foods because they want to lose weight. It has nothing to do with spiritual life, right? But they just want to give up eating rich foods because they're putting on weight. They want to look attractive in this world. So our acharyas explain that because of our material life, we suffer from these three kind of propensities in the material world. The desire to enjoy the fruits of our actions, the desire to accomplish things in this world, and the desire to give up things that have nothing to do with Krishna consciousness. Right? And all of these three things, are these contaminations, are purified by the process of bhakti yoga. Specifically chanting the holy name, free from offenses. And what does it do? So, what does it mean to be conditioned? What does it mean to be conditioned? You can think of it as like a little physics experiment. This is consciousness, right? This is the self. Actually, this is the soul. Think of this as the soul. From the soul emanates something called consciousness. This Krishna explains in the 13th chapter of the Gita. Just like the sun illuminates the universe, or just like this light illuminates this temple room, then consciousness illuminates the body. Isn't it? The soul is situated in the body, and through the medium of consciousness, it illuminates the whole body. Just like right now, Mike, if I tickle your foot, you'll feel it. Why? Because there's consciousness in that foot. Even though your soul is very small, it's situated in a particular part of your heart, it spreads its influence throughout the body through the medium of consciousness. So you have sensation on your foot, you have sensation in your ear. Now when people have health issues or strokes, then consciousness retracts from that part of the body, and that's what we call having a, what do we call that in medical terms? Paralysis, right? Paralysis, that's what it is. A paralysis is simply consciousness being withdrawn from a certain part of the body. So you touch that part of the body, no sensation. You cannot lift it, you cannot feel anything from that part of the body. Or when consciousness withdraws itself from the ears, what happens then? What do we call that in medical terms? Being deaf, because the ears can no longer function. So basically, the instrument of the body requires consciousness to function properly. Does that make sense so far? So what happens is you have the soul, and the soul illuminates the body with the light of consciousness. Right? Yeah, I know it's a little distracting when people walk in the middle of class. No worries. It's Diwali, you know, it's an auspicious day, so people are coming to get the blessings of Kishore Kishori. Okay, I hope I have your attention. Please focus. I know it's a little technical, but it's important to understand this. So here's the soul. It illuminates the body through the light of consciousness, okay? This light hits the mirror of the mind, and it reflects back. Does that make sense? Just like when you look at yourself in the mirror, what's happening is there is light that goes off of your body and hits the mirror, and I don't exactly know how diffraction and all this works, but the idea essentially is that light is somehow traveling from you to the mirror and bouncing back and then creating an image in the back of your brain and behind your eyes. Does that make sense? Now, what happens if the mirror is cracked? If the mirror is cracked, you look in the mirror and you see thousands of you. Right? Or if it's one of those trick mirrors, like when we were kids, my parents took me to haunted houses, and you looked in the mirror and you looked like 400 pounds. Does that make sense? So these are oblong mirrors and they reflect back a deformed image. So you're looking at yourself, but you seem to be 400 pounds. Or you're really skinny. You know what I'm saying? They have these. Or like if you have Snapchat, same effect, you know, it just morphs your face and your facial features. So this is what the acharyas explain is a polluted mind. So when the mind, the mirror of the mind is covered with dust, the light of consciousness cannot reflect back a pure image. So then the soul looks at the mind, and what reflects back is a contaminated idea of oneself. I am this body, I am this mind, I'm a white person, I'm a this, I'm a that. The varieties of false ego that exist in the world. Does that make sense? What's happening through the process of bhakti is that the mirror is slightly being cleansed. The dust is being removed. so that the light of consciousness reflects a pure image back. And when the mirror is completely cleansed, then the self sees the soul. Yeah, the self sees the soul. But if one purifies the mind through bhakti sadhana, then the self sees the supreme and the self. This is the idea. If you purify the mind through any other process, like jnana yoga, something like that, then one has just perception of the atma, the self. Right? But if one purifies the mind through the process of bhakti, then one sees the self and the supreme simultaneously. And one sees their intrinsic relationship. Why is that? Because from the very beginning, the foundational teachings of bhakti yoga are very simple. We are eternal parts and parcels of God. Right? God is the source of all consciousness. We have an eternal relationship with Him of love and service. And the process of bhakti is to reconnect in that relationship. That's like 101, isn't it? It's bhakti 101. If someone were to ask you, like someone recently asked me, what is your religion all about? So this is what we say. We're eternal souls. We come from God. We have an eternal relationship with God. And we resume that eternal relationship by loving devotional service. Bhakti 101. So when you purify your heart with this foundational understanding, then when the mirror of the mind is clear, one sees the soul and Krishna simultaneously. And that's very powerful. That's what we want. Makes sense so far? All good? Clear? Any questions so far? I know it's a little technical, but I thought to make the morning class a little technical, so it's a little brain exercise. But also, this is what the verse is talking about. I'm just expanding on the verse in the Bhagavatam. It's talking about purification, so we should understand what is it that we're being purified of, if that makes sense. So, carrying on, now we understand that the holy names are the most powerful form of purifying ourselves in the age of Kali, right? And I can speak for myself. I've been chanting now for 9 years. I feel slightly purified, but there's a lot of contamination left, okay? So now, if the holy names are so powerful, why am I still so contaminated? Anybody has some answer? Some take? Why do you think, why is Harisham still so contaminated after years of chanting Hare Krishna? Why is the holy name not purifying me immediately, like it can? Any guesses? Inattentive chanting? Anybody else? Offenses to the holy name. So in a blanket category, Prabhu just nailed it. Offenses to the holy name. Anybody else? Anything more subtle? Anything somebody else wants to contribute some understanding? The atmosphere? What do you mean? I see, so you're saying because we live in such a passionate society, it becomes a little harder to purify the heart. It's true, because passion means desire, and living in a place like Chicago creates a lot of desires. It's just the nature of being in a passionate environment. Like, I remember whenever I go to New York City, I come out of Penn Station, and I just look at all the buildings, and I'm like, I want to go shopping. I want pizza. You know what it's like. You know exactly what it's like. You look at these buildings, you have no desire to buy any of these things. You're just like, I want to buy that bag. That's a nice jacket. I want some pizza, man. You know, New York City has that effect, isn't it? Spontaneous arousal of material desires. As soon as you step out of Penn Station, you're like, wow, I want to see the Rockefeller Center. This is cool. You know, that's what happens in a very passionate environment. Mike, you were going to say something? Desires are having like, distract. So, and therefore that leads to inattentive chanting. Correct. I was wondering if you could speak a little soft, because now we have our morning Bhagavatam class. I apologize. No worries. So, yeah, probably you were saying. Not having a goal. Yeah. Beautiful point. So another reason why the chanting doesn't work as effectively as it should is because we haven't fixed ourselves on the goal of the chanting, that I want to go back to Krishna. So anyways, it's okay. It's an auspicious festival, so people are happy. So if we don't fix ourselves on the goal of the chanting and therefore allow ourselves to become distracted by the numerous desires, then the chanting won't work as effectively also. So yeah, I wanted to churn this a little bit just to hear what everyone has to say. So I'll quote now a verse from the Padma Purana that supports everything that we're saying and furthers the point. It says, O Brahmana, if the Lord's holy name is cast among the atheists who are lustful towards the body, material possessions and family members, it will not quickly produce the fruit of love for him. So those who are atheists, who don't have faith in God, and who have a lot of desires to enjoy their material possessions and the things of this world, then the holy name will not quickly produce the fruit of love for Krishna, because of being distracted, because of numerous desires. So I thought this verse was very interesting. I found it in a commentary to Upadeshamrita. And I was meditating on this verse, and I was thinking about how important it is to chant devoid of desires to enjoy the things of this world. And there's actually a very nice section of the Chaitanya Charitamrita where Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu expands on this point of how when we hear and chant, we are giving rise to the creeper of devotion in our hearts. Right? When you chant, basically there's a little creeper that grows in your heart that eventually keeps growing and reaches the spiritual world. Okay, and that's what chanting and hearing is compared to watering that creeper. Does that make sense? It's like you have a garden, and in that garden you plant a tree, and you water that tree with hearing and chanting, and it keeps growing and it keeps growing. But what happens along with, whenever anybody who knows gardening knows, along with the tree also grows some weeds. Exactly. So one has to be very careful that the nutrition one pours into the soil isn't consumed by the weeds. And so Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explains in great detail what are some of these weeds that grow along with our bhakti creeper and that are actually being watered by our chanting. This is the subtle point, that when we chant with material desires, we're actually furthering our material desires, because the holy name is? Holy name is? What is the holy name? Chintamani. What does that mean, Prabhu? And what does that mean? It's a touchstone. So whatever you want from it, it provides. So you chant the holy name with material desires, Krishna sees the heart. He's like, oh, you really want a new red bicycle? Okay. Next week, you know, some devotee shows up. Prabhu, I have a bicycle I don't need. You think, wow, chanting really works. It happens. It happens to all of us. I mean, you know, and I'm not ashamed to say it. I have material desires. And I notice how by chanting with material desires, my desires get fulfilled. I don't chant with the intention of fulfilling my material desires. It's not like I'm chanting thinking my material desires should get fulfilled. They're just there. And I'm trying to get rid of them, but they're there. And chanting fulfills them. It's just what chanting does. So one has to be so careful. So let us hear these verses from Chaitanya Charitamrita, because they're very, very, you could say they're very important for our spiritual life. So it's Madhya Leela, chapter 19, text 151 onwards. So I'll give you a few seconds to pull it up. Madhya Leela, chapter 19, text 151 onwards. If you would like to hear them, you can maybe sit next to someone who has a phone, then you can share together. So we'll just, maybe what we'll do again is we'll just pass out the mic. So I'll read two verses and then we'll pass down the mic. And this time we'll start from here. Is that okay? No worries. Then we'll start from, so Madhya Leela chapter 19, text 151 onwards. And then maybe we can start over there. So I'll read verses 151 and 152. Does everybody have it pulled up? Yeah? Prabhuji? You have it pulled up? Sure, take your time, no worries. Okay. According to their karma, all living entities are wandering throughout the entire universe. Some of them are being elevated to the upper planetary systems, and some are going down into the lower planetary systems. Out of many millions of wandering living entities, one who is very fortunate gets an opportunity to associate with a bona fide spiritual master by the grace of Krishna. By the mercy of both Krishna and the spiritual master, such a person receives the seed of the creeper of devotional service. Right, so then from the mercy of the guru, what is the mercy of the guru? The mercy of the guru is that he plants within the heart the aspiration for devotional service. That's what the guru, at the time of initiation, even before initiation, the contact with the sadhu, is that he plants within the heart a desire for pure devotional service. That's what he does. When a person receives the seed of devotional service, he should take care of it by becoming a gardener and sowing the seed in his heart. If he waters the seed gradually by the process of Shravan and Kirtan, the seed will begin to sprout. So now the seed is in the heart. Now begins our job. Our job is to hear and chant nicely so the seed sprouts. Okay? Next two verses, would you like to read, Prabhu? Verse 153. Shabali Prabhu, you want to give him the mic? Okay, anybody else wants to read? You have the verses? You want to give it to someone who can read it? Okay, Adam's got it. Okay, let's start here. It's already here. Let's start. You start. And then it'll pass it down.
As one waters the Bhatki, Lata, Bija, the seed sprouts and the creeper gradually grows to the point where it penetrates the walls of this universe and goes beyond the Viraja River, lying between the spiritual world and the material world. It attains Brahma Loka, the Brahman effulgence, and penetrating through that stratum, it reaches the spiritual sky and the spiritual planet, Goloka Vrindava.
Beautiful. So, a description of the creeper's journey through the layers of the material world, past the Viraja River. There is a river that flows in the universe that divides the material and the spiritual realms. Now, don't think of it as a river that we see here, you know. It's not like the same kind of idea, but it's a river of some sort. I don't know what it looks like because I haven't seen it, but it's some sort of division between the material and the spiritual realms, and the creeper goes through that also, enters the spiritual world. Okay, who wants to read the next verse? He's got it.
Being situated in one's heart and being watered by the Shravana Kirtan, the Bhakti Creeper grows more and more. In this way, it attains the shelter of the desired tree of the lotus feet of Krishna, who is eternally situated in the planet known as Goloka Vrindavan, the topmost region of the spiritual sky.
Can you read one more? Because we have a few verses to go and time is of the essence.
The creeper greatly expands in Goloka Vrindavan planet and there produces the fruit of love for Krishna. Although remaining in the material world, the gardener regularly sprinkles the creeper of water with the hearing and chanting.
Wonderful. Next person who wants to read, Adam.
If the devotee commits an offense at the feet of a Vaishnava while cultivating the creeper of devotional service in the material world, his offense is compared to a mad elephant that uproots the creeper and breaks it. In this way, the leaves of the creeper are dried up.
One more, please.
The gardener must defend the creeper by fencing it all around so that the powerful elephant of offenses may not enter.
Right, so the first danger to the creeper is offenses. Now, a second danger will be mentioned. Who would like to read? You would like to read? Mm-hmm. Can someone pass him a phone? Prabhuji Dushyant would like to read. Just pass him your phone. Dushyant, please read verses 158 and 159.
Sometimes unwanted creepers, such as the creepers of desires for material enjoyment and liberation from the material world, grow along with the creeper of devotional service. The varieties of such unwanted creepers are unlimited.
Yes, the varieties of desires that we can experience in the material world are unlimited, isn't it? Every day some new desires emerge. One more verse, please.
Some unnecessary creepers growing with the bhakti creeper are the creepers of behavior, unacceptable for those trying to attain perfection, diplomatic behavior, animal killing, mundane profiteering, mundane adoration, and mundane importance. All these are unwanted creepers.
And then the last two verses, very, very important. Who would like to read? Anybody? Jai Baldev, you want to read? Okay, Alex, you got his hand up. Last two verses, please.
If one does not distinguish between the bhakti creeper and the other creepers, the sprinkling of water is misused.
Please read that phrase one more time. Read that phrase one more time. It's such an important phrase. If
one does not distinguish between the bhakti creeper and the other creepers, the sprinkling of water is misused because the other creepers are nourished while the bhakti creeper is curtailed. As soon as an intelligent devotee sees an unwanted creeper growing beside the original creeper, he must cut it down instantly.
Yes.
Then the real creeper, the Bhakti Lata, grows nicely, returns home back to Godhead, and seeks shelter under the lotus feet of Krishna.
Interesting, isn't it? We don't think about this so much, how our practice of bhakti is also feeding sometimes the weeds, and these weeds have the potentiality to choke our creeper. So here's what Srila Prabhupada writes in text 159. He says, all these obstructions have been described in this verse as unwanted creepers. They simply present obstacles for the real creeper. One should be very careful to avoid all these unwanted things. Sometimes these unwanted things look exactly like the bhakti creeper. They appear to be of the same size and the same species when they are packed together with the bhakti creeper. But in spite of this, the creepers are called upashaka. A pure devotee can distinguish between the bhakti creeper and a mundane creeper, and he is very alert to distinguish them and keep them separate. I mean, Mother Krishna Archana is quite learned in the art of psychology, so I'm sure we could have a long discussion on this point of how the substance looks a lot like the illusion, doesn't it? Sometimes one thinks, I'm doing this for my spiritual advancement. It looks like bhakti, actually, but it might be impelled by completely the wrong motivations. If one preaches, if one serves, if one cooks, dances, hears about Krishna, not with a desire to please Krishna, but because one wants to be known as a learned devotee, one wants to impress everybody else with one's learning, one wants to, you know, this recently happened. We had a 12-hour kirtan, and I'm not going to say who did this, but someone did this. Someone came up to me and was asking me for a slot to lead the kirtan. And their justification was, well, somebody else also got to lead, so I also want to lead. And I told this devotee, Prabhu, this is not the mood. This is not the mood of chanting in kirtan that I need to get a slot. Let me sing. I also want a slot, you know. Why do you want a slot? You want to chant kirtan? You can sit in the audience and participate like everybody else. Why do we have to be the center of attention? You know what I'm saying? So this tendency can sometimes choke our bhakti creeper. The desire to lead kirtan is not meant for our glorification, it's meant for their glorification. You know what I'm saying? So one has to be very, very careful in the execution of spiritual life, that we don't make this mistake of doing bhakti for the wrong reasons. And then we won't be able to tell, you know, why are we, you know, what is, we if we're not able to distinguish between the creeper versus the weed, then eventually we get tricked in the material world. So anyways, this is a very deep section, and I encourage all of you to go back and study it on your own. Now it's already 8:25. I don't like going past 8:30, and I like leaving a few minutes for discussion. I could go into this whole discussion on ashrams. I had a lot of notes prepared on talking about the last verse, which was verse number 34, which talks about ashrams, but I don't know what to do. What should I do? Should we just pause and have discussion, huh? Abbreviated. Okay, I'll follow Mother Krishna Archana's instruction. She's like my mother, so if she says it, we have to do it. Okay, so the 34th verse makes a very good point that in this material world, there are four ashrams, and each of these ashrams involves some sort of suffering. And the process of bhakti is that which frees us from the suffering in each ashram. Now, what does it mean that ashrams involve suffering? Let's explain a little bit. There's four ashrams. Brahmacharya. What's next? Grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. You can think of ashrams as jobs. Each job has a job description. To do a job nicely, you have to follow the job description. One can be a cook. Okay, that has a certain job description. You're supposed to work with the line cooks. You do this, you do that. Now, but there's bad cooks and there's good cooks, isn't it? So just being a cook doesn't mean you're following the job description. So just being a brahmachari doesn't mean you're following the job description. Just being a grihastha doesn't mean you're a grihastha. Being a sannyasi doesn't mean you're a sannyasi. Follow? A real sannyasi, a real brahmachari, a real grihastha is one who follows the job description of that particular ashram. Now, what is the austerity in brahmachari life? The austerity in brahmachari life is simplicity. Service to one's authorities, to one's gurus, to one's elders and mentors. Living simply. A brahmachari doesn't accumulate much. He tries to live as simply as possible, and his main duty is to serve, to hear and to chant. So if a brahmachari isn't living simply, isn't following his authorities, isn't dedicating a good portion of his time in hearing the Vedic literatures, in hearing and chanting, then this is not very good. then he's not actually following the job description of his ashram. He's not becoming a successful brahmachari. Does that make sense? So a brahmachari follows these things. He lives simply, he works under authority and guidance, and he focuses on education, hearing and chanting. If he's doing these three things, he's fulfilling the duties of his ashram nicely. And by that, he'll become situated in the mode of goodness, and he'll please Krishna. So why do we follow the ashrams carefully? Because Krishna sets up the ashrams, and he declares what are the duties of each ashram. And by doing them according to his instruction, we please him, right? Just like if I help you move your things from your old house to your storage, and I follow your instructions according to your desires, I move the things as you want me to, what will happen? You'll be satisfied, you'll be happy, right? That I picked up the boxes like you wanted me to, I moved everything like you wanted me to. So when we live our ashram according to Krishna's desire, Krishna is pleased, which is the goal of bhakti, by the way, is to please the Lord. So that's what it means to be a brahmachari. So if one is in a brahmachari ashram, one should know, what are my responsibilities? What are my duties? Yes, there's suffering involved, right? But by doing it for Krishna, then the suffering becomes a source of joy. What is the suffering in the grihastha ashram? The suffering is one has to be very responsible. People's lives depend on us, right? A grihastha is somebody who has to work to maintain his wife, his children, his extended family, and the other ashrams. A grihastha is supposed to give donations. A grihastha is supposed to use his house as a facility to serve other devotees, to serve his guru or her guru. That is the austerity in the grihastha ashram. One cannot have a sense of possessiveness as a grihastha, that, oh, look at me, I've accumulated so much money and property, this is all mine. No, Prabhupada says a grihastha is meant to serve the other three ashrams. And there's some suffering there, that you work hard, right? You make money, and then you have to give it away to somebody else. That's not always the nicest feeling, you know? But this is the job description of the grihastha ashram, that one uses one's facility in order to serve. And one is very, very responsible in maintaining one's wife and children. A grihastha is also responsible for the emotional, physical, and spiritual health of one's dependents. The first responsibility for a grihastha is to make sure that his wife or her husband, the kids, are emotionally, physically, and spiritually nourished. That means creating an environment where that's safe, that's sheltering, that's protective, and ultimately spiritually uplifting. That also requires work, by the way. It's not so easy being a good grihastha. If one wants to know what is a good grihastha, just approach one of the good grihasthas and ask them, what does it take? And they'll tell you, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to be that responsible. A brahmachari just has to maintain his personal sadhana and do his duty, service, and his few possessions. Life is simple, isn't it, Adam? Adam's going to Florida today, he's going to Miami. Who wouldn't want to be in Miami on a cold day like this, right? Life is good. He's going to go into Sankirtan, he'll preach, he'll cultivate people, he'll distribute books, he'll have ecstatic conversations. Life is good. You don't have to go to work. This is your work. Life is fun, right? But you have to force yourself to live simply. You have to listen to your authority's instructions, and sometimes you may not like that. There is some annoyance there. It's possible. It happens. So in the same way, the grihastha ashram also has some suffering involved. But if the grihastha uses his facility for bhakti, the suffering is minimized. What is the suffering in vanaprastha ashram? The last ashram, the third ashram. We don't see too many vanaprasthis, but what is the suffering in vanaprastha ashram? Anybody want to take a guess? What is the suffering in vanaprastha ashram? A gradual divestment. So the vanaprast, he's spent 20, 25 years of his life cultivating a grihastha life and creating a family, business, money, all of those things. A proper vanaprastha starts to minimize those things and give some of those things away and reduce the clutter in one's life, basically preparing him or herself for complete absorption in the Lord's service. There's some suffering there because one might be attached to one's possessions, one's property, one's wealth, all of those things, and one has to gradually reduce those things, start doing more austerities as an example for young people. You follow what I'm saying? Because when it's not very inspiring when we see old people and they're just trying to enjoy life like the young people. We think even in the material world, when you see old people trying to act like 20-year-olds, it just feels off. You know what I'm saying? It just feels off. It just doesn't feel right. So even a non-devotional entity can tell that old people trying to just live like young people just feels wrong. Because that's not natural. The natural order is that as you get older, one minimizes one's engagement with the world to serve, to become more spiritual. And then it feels very natural. And that's the austerity for the vanaprastha. And for the sannyasi, the austerity is constant traveling, constant preaching. And like Maharaj points out in his purport, without sex desire. A sannyasi can never go back. A brahmachari has every right to get married. If a brahmachari decides, I want to have a family, he's free to do so. If a grihastha decides, I want to expand my family, have more children, he's free to do so. A vanaprast, no. A sannyasi, no. That's an austerity. An ideal sannyasi is one who never goes back to grihastha life. He maintains his ashram. And that means preaching constantly, traveling, living a very high example of just renunciation, austerity, absorption in Krishna consciousness. It's the renounced order of life, the most elevated ashram in society. They earn all the respect. In a proper Vedic culture, sannyasis get a lot of respect from the members of society. So they deserve it because of their austerity, their preaching, their... Are you okay? You alright? Okay, cool. So these are the different responsibilities of each ashram. And as you can see, doing it well requires some work. It doesn't come so easily. But the verse is pointing out that by the process of bhakti, then that suffering in those ashrams is minimized. And did I make all my points? Yeah, and the last point I wanted to make was that when we do our ashram successfully, we become purified of ignorance and passion. We become situated in the mode of goodness. We learn the art of responsibility. We actually become detached from the enjoyment of this world. Because see, it's like the sour grapes. You know the story, the jackal couldn't eat the grapes, so he thought, anyways, they must be sour, because he didn't have the strength to enjoy the grapes. So he just renounced the grapes, thinking they must be sour. Proper renunciation happens either on the basis of knowledge or experience. Either one understands that the material world is not a place to be happy and therefore doesn't pursue it, or one experiences the best of what this world has to offer and then realizes it still wasn't enough. You follow? So depending on the individual, somebody already has the experience. The material world isn't going to make me happy. So he doesn't have to engage himself too much with the world. He already has that realization. Some, we don't have that realization yet. So therefore it's recommended, engage with the material world responsibly, as a grihastha and all of that, responsibly and with maturity. And then one gets the realization, oh, I did the material program nicely and I'm still feeling unfulfilled, you know? Therefore, I should just become fully Krishna conscious. So either way, but if one pretends that I have this realization, I already feel so elevated spiritually, then one won't succeed, either as a brahmachari or as a grihastha. The proper program is, one has to study one's consciousness and observe, do I have this realization? And if one doesn't, then okay, how do I get this realization? Then one should go through the proper methodology to gain that realization. Because the purpose of the grihastha ashram, purpose of all the ashrams, is to make us more Krishna conscious. Right? So, that was my presentation for today. Sorry, I went a few minutes over time. I apologize. Does anybody have anything they want to add? A quick comment or reflection? Yes, Prabhu.
You touched on it a little bit about how sometimes our psychology can be thinking we're engaged in, you know, a particular service, but yeah, it can be kind of fall into sense gratification. And so it's a very subtle thing sometimes. So that the idea of the yukta vairagya, using everything's in Krishna service, yeah, that, you know, we may be kind of telling ourselves that, but we may be actually doing a whole different thing.
Exactly,
so
yeah.
I guess there has to be some kind of checks and balances by, you know, asking people what they think about how we'd be using things in Krishna service, because our minds can kind of tricking us into thinking, well, I'm using it in a Krishna service.
Yeah, but it might be in our service.
We're just falling into more illusion, yeah, because of it.
Yeah, if you study that verse, the verse actually begins with anasaktasya vishayam upaham yataham upayunjita. So anasaktasya vishayam means without the desire to enjoy, one can then engage the things of this world in Krishna's service. So yeah, you're right. Sometimes we may be engaging in yukta vairagya, thinking I'm using it in Krishna's service, Prabhu, but internally it may just be for our service. It's, the line is tricky, and that's why it's good to have mentors and guides who can, like you say, point out that I think this is too much, you know. This is becoming too much for your enjoyment. It's not for the Lord's pleasure, so you need to pull back a little. Like that, nice point, thank you. Anybody else has anything they want to add? Short, quick reflection. Just keep it really short, Prabhu, because it's already past 8:30.
Hare Krishna, thank you for your class. You were mentioning about the one devotee asking for a time slot.
Yeah.
Of course, he was honest enough to ask for one, so I commend his honesty. Sometimes we want to ask for a slot.
That's true.
So one thing you could find is glorious, he was honest enough to ask for a slot.
Good point. Yeah, he was honest enough to express his desires.
There's a verse from a section in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, the Anshakan, chapter 9. And in that section, describes the pastime Brihgamoni when he offends his superior, Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu. Mm. And he offended his superior. So the interesting thing about that verse, it says that anyone who sees Brihgamoni as an aparadhi, who's offending his superiors, that person is guilty of committing aparadhas because they don't know that the Lord actually inspired Brihgamoni to offend his aparadhis. So one lesson I've learned that I have to learn over my life many times is like what I was mentioning the other day, what Prabhupada said in chapter 17, verse 15. Unless, generally speaking, somebody has accepted us as their guru or mentor or advisor, that could cause like friction in the relationships. And one last point I'd like to mention, and one thing I keep in mind, it may not be a good analogy before prasadam, but when we live in a building with roommates, everyone's experienced this. When somebody's used the bathroom, number two, you go in, you can't tolerate the smell. But when we use the bathroom, we somehow or other, we don't smell anything. Yeah. So that's the lesson I'd say. We could tolerate the faults that come out of others, but we cannot tolerate the faults that come out of someone else. That's why Buddha says, he says a nice quote, not the perversities of others, not their sins of commission or omission, but its own misdeeds and negligences should a sage take notice of. So my question is that how do we kind of learn from these experiences? Because they could cause very bitter relationships. People may not, somebody actually mentioned this to me recently, that some similar thing, and I've had to learn for myself, maybe you could expand on that point.
I mean, I think the simple thing is, you know, we don't, like you said, if someone doesn't see us as a mentor or guide or teacher, then we avoid trying to correct them. Like when this devotee said what he said, I just got really annoyed. And later on, I just went and apologized and I told him why I was annoyed, and that's it. I didn't try to like, now listen, Prabhu, do you understand what it means to do kirtan in a pure spirit? Let me instruct you. No, I was just like, look, I was annoyed because you said this and this is not my understanding. So I'm sorry that I was annoyed. And I just left it at that. And I think that's the healthy approach, because if someone doesn't see you as someone who can instruct them, then your instructing them is just going to agitate them, and then it's not good for them and it's not good for you and it's not proper Vaishnava etiquette. Ideally, one can go to their elders, like someone that they see as mentors, and then inform them, like, hey, so and so was saying like this, and this might not be very good for their spiritual life. Can you say something? You know. That's ideal. Mother Krishna, anything you would like to add to that? Or? Huh? She's always saying like this because she wants to avoid having to speak, but one of these days we'll crack it. She's always like, well, that was very good. And she's so elegant that you can't say anything, you know. That was so nice. And then you're like, I don't think it was that nice, but okay. Okay, jai everyone. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. All right. Otherwise, he says, and you know what, in India, you actually have to do that. Because here, everything is simple. You speak the language, the signs are very clear. It's obnoxious to be that early in America. But in India, you should be very early because everything is confusing. Things are wrong. Sometimes, one time the train departed early. One time. It's not always. I was going to say that